Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, folks, we're going to jump into the show here in just a second. But first, if you're only listening to the free portion of the Bob Seska Show on Apple Podcasts.
Wait. This is taking far too long. Ben Shapiro from the Ben Shapiro Podcast. I'm blitzed on stimulants right now, so I can tell you, as quickly as possible, literally at the speed of sound itself, to not support Bob Seska's Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com vis-a-vis Patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. He talks too slowly, and so do his co-hosts. And everyone knows, the faster someone talks, the smarter he sounds. So seriously, don't sign up for Bob's Patreon. Thank you. I'll be over here waiting for puberty. Come on, puberty.
Again, that's BobSeskaShow.com. Bookmark it and send it to all your friends, and we thank you in advance. And now, let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Today's Rachel Maddow Show Award for Headline Excellence goes to Bob Seska.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, August 18, 2021, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, my name is Bob. Hello.
Hello, Bob.
Hello. Day 211 of the Biden-Harris administration, 447 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska and on Twitter at BobSeska_go. Yeah, we've got Spencer Ackerman here today. You might know Spencer from his reporting for The Daily Beast, Wired, The Guardian, The New Republic. He's also the author of a brand new book called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Link in the description at BobSeska.com. The book takes a hard and often harrowing look at how 9/11 led us on an inevitable path to Afghanistan, Iraq, the exploitation of fear by the Bush administration, the war on terror itself. We're also going to talk about the American withdrawal from Afghanistan, of course, and what that's going to mean for the broader war on terror. Meantime, if you dig this show, make sure to sign up for our bonus content at BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, put on your foreign policy and national security hats as we visit with author and journalist Spencer Ackerman. I assume, given the subject of your book, your phone has got to be ringing off the hook this week, huh?
Yeah, kind of.
busy man. You've actually been to Afghanistan. I want to start there. Tell me what you observed on the ground when you were there, the conditions there. How untenable was our presence at the time?
One of the things that I'll always take away from reporting from Afghanistan is a story I tell in the book about one of the few acts of actual battlefield heroism that I observed. And it underscored the way in which the war was entirely untenable. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the war told the soldiers and Marines who fought it that what their mission had to be was to aggressively pursue, close, and kill terrorists, mm-hmm. or people they presumed to be, you know, terrorists and insurgents.
That's right.
Other times they said that the imperative in the war was to protect the populations of, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, and so forth.
That's right.
From predation, either by the insurgency or even sometimes by allied governmental forces, and also kind of tacitly not to commit such predatory acts themselves. And then also it told those who fought the war that sometimes the imperative was to partner with local security forces, institutions that the United States rebuilt after the invasions during the occupations, in order to make sure that they would functionally work themselves out of a job, that as the Afghan, in this case, mentees got better, the U.S. would have less to do and could sort of seamlessly hand over the task to them.
Yeah.
Then what I observed in a part of eastern Afghanistan called Paktia province in a small place called Zormat near the Pakistani border was a case where an American a cavalry platoon goes to pursue a weapons cache of like fenced American weaponry.
Yeah, yeah.
And goes in a kind of hairy way to a compound where a bunch of women live. And they meet up with the Afghan police because restrictions at the time say that the Americans can't enter an Afghan's house without, you know, Afghan accompaniment.
And this was a group of older women, right? Elderly Afghans?
Some were very elderly. Others were not so much. Mm-hmm. Then what happens once they go in, they come out with the guy they were looking for. In this case, who the women had been sheltering. Mm-hmm. And they take him, you know, they put flex cuffs on him, and they take him to custody. And then one of the Afghan policemen goes back inside as all of these women are outside wailing and moaning at the fact that they had just had their home invaded,
yeah.
Including by foreigners. And one of the policemen, the guy who ends up going back inside, like has a pole and he starts kind of swinging it like dangerously near these women. And one of them who's very old and very small, like topples over and like takes a bit of a spill. And now the women are really upset. Hmm. This guy goes inside the compound and comes out with their motorcycle, revs the engine. And it was very clear to me and, you know, to everyone else, certainly to those women, what was happening here. The Afghan police were robbing the place.
Yeah.
And there was an American platoon sergeant who in the book I call Sergeant Rob, who quickly goes over to his lieutenant and says that the lieutenant has to take action here. We can't stop the Afghan police. We have to stop the Afghan police from, you know, stealing this. Motorcycle. And, you know, at first the lieutenant, you know, as is, you know, very often the case with lieutenants, is kind of hesitant and not totally sure, you know, which of the imperatives of the war is the operative one in this moment. But Sergeant Rob, like a good non-commissioned officer is supposed to do, steers the lieutenant toward the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And informs the Afghan policeman that he's not leaving with the motorcycle. The Afghan police at that point decide, all right, the mission is over. If you want to go find that weapons cache, good luck to you, but we're heading back to the station. And that was what passed for heroism in Afghanistan. That was a circumstance in which people in a place halfway around the world where they didn't speak the language had to navigate between what the war was supposed to be like and what reality was. And they had in very small moments, so numerous in accumulation over 20 years of war to make those decisions. And those decisions guided the course of the war.
Yeah.
Individually, they might not have had more than a tactical impact. Collectively, they were the Afghanistan War.
It's striking to hear these stories of heroism and to know that it was ultimately in service of this futile effort there, where the outcome was always going to be inevitable. I mean, the word that keeps crossing my mind for the past several days is inevitable. Eventually, this was all going to fall apart the way it has.
Absolutely, it was doomed to fail. The war on terror is you know conceptually doomed from the start. The war in Afghanistan, it's amazing, you know, and many people are perhaps too young to remember. But shortly after invading Afghanistan, there was this round of discourse about how, you know, Afghanistan was the graveyard of empires.
Yeah.
You know, Alexander the Great could not conquer Afghanistan. The British could not hold Afghanistan. The Russians could not hold Afghanistan. That this was a pretty astonishing historical constant. It was, in fact, one of the historical constants that the CIA relied on in the 1980s in order to fuel the Afghan insurgency against the Soviet occupation.
Yeah.
And once Kabul fell and American television cameras broadcast children streaming out into the streets, flying kites, Kabul coming kind of back to life after the repression of the Taliban, all of that evaporated in a swell of hubris that said that the United States, as it sees itself, is the exception here, that American exceptionalism had been vindicated, that it would be America that could do this impossible task. And even as America recognized, this is very characteristic, I think, of the United States, that this historical circumstance pertained, it decided it was the exception to it. And in fact, it never was.
Yeah.
In December of 2001, shortly after this event happened, pretty much weeks after, you know, the liberation of Kabul, the Taliban bivouac to Kabul. I'm sorry, bivouac to Kandahar. And they expect to, like, make a stand there in order to hold their kind of, you know, ancestral, you know, territory. They're on their home court here.
Right.
And it doesn't go their way. And it goes so badly for them at the hands of the U.S.'s Afghan allies that the Taliban decide instead to sue for peace. And they say to representatives of the U.S.'s chosen proxy, Hamid Karzai, that we're going to agree to demobilize, we'll disarm, we will accept negotiations to join a successor government. The only request that we have, the only condition we put on this, is that our leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, gets to live under some kind of house arrest in Kandahar. And Karzai, cognizant of Afghan history, particularly recent Afghan history, where the Taliban, like, waged a civil war and won it, takes the deal because he recognizes that if the Taliban don't have a political future, then they'll opt for a military future.
Right.
Donald Rumsfeld gets in front of the Pentagon podium and says that such a deal is unacceptable to the United States of America, which will seek nothing less than unconditional surrender. And that's the moment the war is lost. That's the moment where the U.S. takes over Afghanistan on an absolutely ignorant and unrealistic definition of what it can possibly achieve.
Yeah.
A hubristic refusal to recognize that it had what could pass for victory at low cost in front of its face and decided not to pursue it. Everything that happened over the previous 20 years made the Taliban stronger, to the point that when the Trump administration, rightly, in my view, pursued a negotiation to end the war with the Taliban, recognizing the Taliban as a fact that was not able to be wished away, it sought the terms that the U.S. rejected in 2001. The difference was that the U.S. had maximum leverage in 2001 and minimal leverage in 2020.
Yeah.
I went to Afghanistan in 2008 and then again in 2010. And I didn't, you know, go everywhere. I, you know, I don't want to pretend like I was some, like, you know, big war correspondent. I spent 2 months in Afghanistan out of 20 years. But one thing that I'll always remember is that when I came back in 2010 and flew into Kabul, the streets were vastly more congested than they were in 2008. And the reason for that was all of the refugees from the war, from around the country, that had swarmed into the capital where, you know, with the exception of a couple terrorist attacks a year, I don't want to say that to minimize it, the war primarily was not in Kabul. And when we see the desperation that we've seen over the past week, given the Taliban victory, it is a mistake to attribute that to America ceasing to fight the war. This is what the war led to.
Yeah.
These are the wages of the war. This is how America grabbed defeat from the jaws of what could pass for victory. And we should remember that so that we never repeat this again and we don't force other peoples to suffer through the violent nightmare of the 20 years that America unleashed in Afghanistan.
Were we the only delusional ones there, Spencer, or was the Afghan security forces and police, the government from Karzai on down to Ghani, were they all thinking, okay, this is inevitably going to be America bugging out and the Taliban returning to power? Was that kind of a known, as Rumsfeld used to say, among all the Afghan people? And we were the ones thinking, well, you know, eventually everything's going to be fine.
The Afghan people know their history in a way that the United States, you know, American people very often, we don't know our own. Mm-hmm. They had no illusions of the way the United States would act. They had no illusions that the United States would be able to wage war in Afghanistan forever. You know, as this war went terribly longer than it went well. Yeah. And I was only there during times when it had gone terribly. And what I heard from Afghans was precisely that like the United States doesn't care about us. The United States is not building these institutions for us.
Yeah.
The United States is building these institutions for itself so it can operate and exercise power. Its preference is through proxy. That's what the Afghan people understood.
So when this all went down over this past week with the withdrawal, I assume all of these people who knew that the United States was not there for altruistic purposes, that we had certainly an agenda there. I assume they all now feel vindicated in that assumption.
I don't really think vindication is what Afghans are feeling right now or looking to feel.
Yeah.
I don't want to ventriloquize anyone.
Okay.
But, you know, this isn't an argument that's unfolding in Afghanistan. This is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
This is something that is prompting people to run after C-17s, trying desperately to grab a hold of them and then falling to their deaths in the way that, you know, I could only remember watching live as I'm a native New Yorker, 2,900 almost of my neighbors burned to death, and some of them chose to jump from the towers instead. So I don't think this is a moment where people are looking, particularly Afghans themselves, at, you know, saying that they were right all along. That's just not the human reaction.
Turning now to the war on terror and the post 9/11 era, it seems to me as if in recent memory, America has suffered from at least two or three national nervous breakdowns. One that we're experiencing right now, maybe another one in 2009 after Obama was elected in the middle of the Great Recession and all the backlash about that. And of course, in 2001, right after 9/11 into 2002, on and on through the early 2000s. How much of the public support for the war on terror was based on post-traumatic stress from the spectacle of 9/11?
I don't think that American foreign policy and national security is remotely meaningfully democratic.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is a major, major mistake to view the war on terror as the result of leaders listening to a popular will.
Yeah.
There was certainly a bloodlust. I felt that bloodlust myself.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bloodlust cultivated by media figures and by political figures in order to get the war on terror.
Yeah.
That was how the interpretations of what had happened on 9/11 were presented to Americans, that an enemy they did not understand, that was interpreted not based on any of its like actual critiques that it presented, that had to do with the suffering that Muslims experienced at the hands of America and America's proxies,
mm-hmm.
Whether through, you know, bombing, whether through sanctions, whether through U.S.-backed repression and so forth. Instead, the United States and the Bush administration in particular, and a tremendous amount of the Democratic Party and journalists presented it as instead the twisted quasi-religious justifications for the violence of Osama bin Laden, who for some reason we never, you know, think of as what he was, which is a billionaire,
mm-hmm.
Who did what billionaires do, and in this case, a rather extreme version of it, which is play with other people's wives.
Yeah.
And instead, by removing those actual material grievances that motivated al-Qaeda, and looking only and presenting only those strange, obscure, and somewhat scary quasi-religious justifications, that allowed the country, that allowed the Bush administration in particular, to present a case of an enemy that was pathological, an enemy that only an expansive war that would last a tremendously long time and take a tremendous effort by the public was needed. And it mediated and I would say, you know, more than that, it suppressed alternative explanations for the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw 9/11 and its culture become what we would now call a cancel culture. Think about people like Susan Sontag, who wrote that, you know, bin Laden has like articulable reasons for doing this and is not just like a mindless, bloodthirsty fanatic. It doesn't mean he's not a bloodthirsty fanatic, mm-hmm. but it doesn't mean he's a mindless one. And for that, she gets canceled until what ultimately becomes, you know, the end of her life. She has to, you know, labor under the burden of being seen as essentially a simp for terrorists. The Dixie Chicks, simply for saying that they were ashamed to be from Texas, like George Bush on the eve of the Iraq invasion, one of the most popular country music acts in the country and hence the world, has their CDs like orgiastically destroyed. That's the culture of 9/11. That's the culture that persists. But it doesn't happen because of some organic desire amongst the public. What had happened was there was in a response to a very real and very deep trauma. I'll never forget seeing what my home, New York, was like after this, breathing the smell of incinerated human beings for days and days and days. Having the skyline of my city transformed into a monument to horror. Our leaders told us the way we had to behave was one that was a door into all of the ugliest, most violent, and most nativist currents in American history. And we had to open that door and let it, like everything from that past, walk through and take power under cover of an emergency. So I don't think it'll do to blame the people. This is what leaders, these are responses that leaders cultivated for their interests.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was an exploitation of that fear that took place. And I can't help but to go back to the 2004 Republican convention, which was wall to wall 9/11. I mean, there's a super edit floating around somewhere on YouTube of all the mentions of September 11th or 9/11, either one of those phrases, just hundreds and hundreds of times. They beat it to death. They were just leaning on that hot button. They were really just poking everybody in their sense of trauma after experiencing the devastation of 9/11. It was so ultimately exploitative. I'd never seen anything like it.
The convention was deliberately in New York for this reason.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That New York's trauma could be put to violent purpose. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forgive that. I will, you know, I find it, you know, That convention was really, really something. The thing is that the Republican Party, in particular, George W. Bush's political strategist, Karl Rove, says very early on in the war on terror that this is a path to entrenching and expanding Republican power in the country. That the war on terror is something that, as he puts it, we can take to the country, and it works. It is what allows the Republicans to expand control of Congress and take the Senate in 2002. And it's what allows George Bush to prevail in his reelection campaign, even as the disaster of the Iraq occupation is very visible. And one of the reasons that that's able to be successful is because the Democratic Party acquiesces to this instead of challenges it.
Okay, we're going to pause here and return to our conversation with Spencer Ackerman in just a second. But first, who doesn't love hanging out in loungewear? Loungewear used to be code for hideously ugly sweatpants. Even your pets were making fun of you. You know they were. But that's a thing of the past, though, with Cozy Earth, the people known for creating luxuriously soft, cool sheets made of bamboo somehow. Well, they've done it again. They've taken loungewear to another level with their comfy, super soft selections and gorgeous styles and colors. From wonderful pajama sets, leggings, and tees, every item is sourced from earth-friendly viscose. Yes, from bamboo for enhanced breathability and temperature regulation. You'll find something you can't lounge without at Cozy Earth. See why Oprah described Cozy Earth's pajamas as the softest ever in O Magazine. Best of all, go to CozyEarth.com now, enter the promo code Stephanie35, and save 35% on their loungewear and bedding. That's CozyEarth.com, promo code Stephanie35. CozyEarth.com. And let's talk about those bags under your eyes. I can't see your bags under your eyes, so I'm not judging you or anything like that. But you know, bags and puffiness under the eyes are a problem for millions of American men and women. Until now. Introducing the new GenuCell Serum with plant stem cell technology from Chamonix. Susan from New Jersey wrote, quote, I've been using GenuCell for a couple of months. The puffiness around my eyes is gone. Even the crow's feet and small lines have disappeared and they haven't come back. I love your product. I use it under my eyes, around my cheekbones, and on my eyelids, unquote. And with its instant effects, you'll see results in the first 12 hours or your money back. I guarantee it. Order now and get 50% off all GenuCell packages for the summer. Go to lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. Again, that's lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. Link in the description. lovegenucell.com/Stephanie. Thank you.
The Bob Seska Show.
Was this all started with the Project for a New American Century? Were they planning for an event like this and getting, I'm not saying necessarily that there was some sort of conspiracy to create the event, but once it happened, were they prepared with a strategy for how to exploit that event and turn it into some of the foreign policy and national security goals they had in mind?
I think that's too kind of overdetermined. Obviously, they didn't anticipate 9/11. What happened was a neoconservative thought leadership apparatus had made an alliance with the regnant kind of Nixonian wing of the Republican Party and the money men, including the oil men. So think like the relationship between the neoconservative Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz and the Nixonian, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and Nixonian Vice President Dick Cheney. Cheney and Rumsfeld want to use 9/11 to demonstrate their preferred course for the way America ought to reassert its dominance globally after what they considered a period of lassitude after the end of the Cold War. And it is, you know, neoconservative figures like Wolfowitz who go about saying, well, here we've actually laid out the intellectual foundations for this. And we can say that what we are doing is a durable strategy to combat, you know, quote unquote, terrorism by dominating the Muslim world and by transforming it into such a thing that, you know, this is the kind of, you know, euphemistic fantasy that Wolfowitz, you know, put out there, that saying we will expand the zones of freedom. And that is what we get as a path to, you know, amongst respected people. This was a respectable opinion. This was not a fringe opinion. This was not considered an outre opinion. This was disputable and disputed at the time. But this perspective, which is psychotic and civilizationally pathologizing, the idea that because a small cadre of violent fanatics led by a billionaire was able to execute a catastrophic terrorist attack, that this exposed a deep rot across the Muslim world was a psychotic racist fantasy that was very useful for the Bush administration and became the way that we invaded Iraq. When people think of neoconservatism now, very often I think they see it as somehow in opposition to Donald Trump and MAGA. It was no such thing. It was the precursor to it. These are in a symbiotic relationship. with one another. They were entirely happy to unleash these violent nativist currents. They just didn't expect that the wolf would eat them too.
It's kind of remarkable to see the same people who cheered for a massive expansion of our national security state right after 9/11 are currently screeching about the dangers of the deep state. Of course, I don't buy the notion of a deep state, but from their perspective, they kind of created the deep state, didn't they?
So the difference between a security apparatus and a deep state in the minds of those who have that critique is loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
Loyalty to a leader, loyalty to a series of propositions that separate through who signs onto allegiance to them, real Americans from conditional Americans.
Yeah.
Who was Donald Trump's biggest security validator? It was Michael Flynn.
Yeah.
Michael Flynn, a creature of the war on terror. Michael Flynn, someone who could legitimately say, as the intelligence chief of the Joint Special Operations Command, and then the intelligence chief of the Afghanistan war, and then as the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, that he fought personally the war on terror at its worst. And the explanation that he took from that experience is that the United States was at war with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he gets fired from the Defense Intelligence Agency because he's kind of crackers, the interpretation that he draws is that, and is willing to sell to Fox News, where he becomes, you know, a talking head, and to the public, is that he has been disgracefully suppressed by craven people who are not prepared to accept that we are in a war with radical Islamic terror. Now, if someone who is the intelligence chief of the Joint Special Operations Command of the Afghanistan war, and then the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, if that person isn't a member of the deep state, then the concept, like in its absurdity, like really is exposed like in that moment.
Yeah.
But what they mean by that is that the difference between a deep state and the, you know, valiant security architecture to protect America is in how civilizationally are you prepared to direct that violence, and how prepared are you to inflict that violence, not just abroad, but on your domestic opposition, which you come to see as an enemy. The night before January 6th, Michael Flynn goes to Washington, D.C. and greets a crowd of Trumpists after he has already called for the military to annul the election and then decide it in Trump's favor.
Mm-hmm.
He asks the assembled crowd, many of whom will not just attend the Stop the Steal rally the next day, but continue on for the insurrection in the Capitol, and asks them if they're prepared to bleed for their freedom.
Wow.
That is the war on terror.
Yeah.
That is how we get from the war on terror to Donald Trump to January 6th.
And so now, how concerned are you about guys like Mike Flynn and some other former national security operatives, as well as former members of the Pentagon and so on, are now kind of forming their own Q cell? Is that something that we should be paying attention to, or is that just so absurd and so fringy that it's not even worth our time?
What do you mean they're forming their own Q cell?
Well, their adherence of Q to an extent. And in fact, there's been a lot of speculation that Mike Flynn was, in fact, Q, although he's not. It's Jim Watkins or Ron Watkins, one of the Watkins guys. But some of these former national security guys are using their knowledge of Q and that whole universe and combining it with their knowledge of the national security state to somehow undermine the current government, or, you know, whatever their goals happen to be. They're all crazy goals. They're all probably unattainable goals, but they're still out there trying to figure out a way to reassert themselves by piggybacking off of Q. And so
there's a guy named Michael Scheuer. Michael Scheuer was the founder of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit.
Mm.
What that also meant was he was the head of the CIA's renditions group that performed kidnapping operations. This was before 9/11. And he ends up becoming a disgruntled figure and a marginalized figure within the CIA and leaves. He goes on quite a journey intellectually and is currently not just a QAnon adherent, but I did a piece on him for the Daily Beast a year and a half ago, in which I talked to the guy about this. But he blogs endlessly about how it is necessary to enact a firestorm to purify America from all of these subhuman non-whites, Jews, they're, you know, the puppet masters of these subhuman non-whites, and the Democrats that do their bidding. And it is explicit, it is, you know, extremely violent, and it has to be taken seriously, because this is someone who used to run rendition operations. This is someone who is intimately familiar with the CIA. This is someone who is not, you know, out of nowhere, you know, wish casting. This is someone who ought to be taken seriously. And this is also a circumstance in which the longer we allow the war on terror to persist, the more it's going to produce circumstances like this, the more it's going to destabilize America.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately, if it's not confronted politically, I don't believe it can be confronted domestically through a war on terror. And I don't think it would be a just thing to do that. We have to be consistent about these things. Then I think we're in for a greater period of danger and destabilization.
Do you think, one last question for you, Spencer, I know you got to go, but with withdrawing from Afghanistan as we have right now, is that starting to close the book on the war on terror, or is this a book that's going to be remaining open for the foreseeable future?
I don't want to be fatalistic about anything. I don't believe, I have a lot of reasons for why I think that is a deep political mistake and one that doesn't have to be made.
Mm-hmm.
But the withdrawal from Afghanistan is by no means the end of the war on terror. You heard you heard Biden say on Monday that he reserves the right to bomb Afghanistan as he sees fit. He reserves the right as well to, as he put it, you know, meet the threats of the future, which is to say permutations of terrorism in new and, you know, perhaps recoalescing places. So that doesn't sound to me like anything's coming to an end. That sounds like to me it's becoming, you know, somewhat receded and inconspicuous or less conspicuous. Beyond that, the 2002 authorization to use military force, one of the major wellsprings of the war on terror, remains in existence.
Yep.
So does the Patriot Act. So does the Department of Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm.
So does ICE. So does the warrant of authorizations for NSA bulk surveillance, which has achieved escape velocity and is now symbiotic with 21st century American, with, well, not American, symbiotic with 21st century capitalism, what the Harvard Business School professor emerita Shoshana Zuboff calls surveillance capitalism. Guantanamo Bay remains open. The indefinite detention apparatus, while, you know, largely fallow at this point, could be spun back up. All of these things continue. All of these things persist. And unless every aspect of it is broken, a future president will reach for these same tools.
Mm-hmm.
Biden will probably reach for these same tools.
Yeah. Incredible. The book is called Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump, by the great Spencer Ackerman. Link in the description under this show, under this episode at bobsesca.com. Thanks so much, Spencer, and good luck to you, my friend. It's got to be an insane week for you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Bob.
Take care. Bye-bye.